Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Spelling for Supremacy, North Dakota's first recorded spelling bee. A lively evening at a Jamestown Baptist church in April of 1885 produced what may be the first recorded spelling bee in North Dakota, and historian Dr. Tom Ezern will let us know how the contest ended and what that winning word was. But we begin Main Street today with former acting U.S. drug czar Richard Baum, who joins the Conversations on Healthcare to discuss his new book, Inside America's Opioid Crisis, 12 Hard Lessons for Today's Drug War, and what decades of a federal drug policy experience have taught him about addiction, treatment, and prevention.
Richard, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. And your new book is titled Inside America's Opioid Crisis, 12 Hard Lessons for Today's Drug War. You're calling for a $10 billion modernization plan to the current federal drug strategy. Tell us why that's needed now.
Yes, thanks for having me, and thanks for that question. You know, like any big area of policy and programmatic activities in the federal government, it is hard to tell sort of how we're doing, because there's definitely been a lot of investment. And the annual drug budget is about $45 billion a year. And of course, that's a lot of money. But my view is that we're doing a lot of things, and some of them are good, and I can definitely could point to innovations and change that's positive. But the question that I have is, how come we're not reaching more people? Mm-hmm. 3/4 of people with an opioid use disorder are not seeking or receiving treatment. We have 28 million people with some type of substance use disorder, and they're not getting the help they need. So I would argue that we're not doing enough. We're not doing all the right things. And when we have innovative model programs, we're not scaling them nationally to bring them to all who could benefit from them.
Well, I'm probably going to stay focused on this particular element for a minute, because the new research shows that opioid-related deaths began to decline in 2023. And drop by nearly half over the next 2 years, which is remarkable. Of course, we saw horrific escalation prior to that point. But as I think you're alluding, you write that research-based knowledge to effectively combat the opioid crisis already exists, but the country has yet to summon the will, the resources, or the compassion to do so. So, I don't know, the latest stats would seem to indicate, as you suggested, maybe we've summoned the will, but not the resources. I think the compassion element is there. And I think from, you know, our perspective, of course, we see such disproportionate impact on certain communities and populations within the country. So tell us more about what you'd like to see happen, either on the will, the resources, or the compassion side.
Yeah, you raised an important point. And it is important news. Overall, drug overdoses are down a bit over 30%. From their peak, and that's important, and I want to acknowledge that progress. But I would say we had this huge increase in overdoses related both to the surge of the availability of fentanyl into the drug supply, which was extremely dangerous, especially when we had about 10 million people who had become or misusing prescription opioids. So we had this bulge of a vulnerable population. Then we had fentanyl, then we had COVID. And so we had this huge surge of overdoses, and that has subsided from its peak. And there are multiple reasons for it, but I would say the leading reason is there has been a important supply interruption, because the source of the way we get fentanyl into the U.S., the way traffickers get it in, is it's produced by the drug cartels in Mexico from precursor chemicals rooted in China. So there's been a disruption in that's temporary and is already ebbing. And if you look closely at the monthly data on the CDC website, that decline is plateauing already, and we have a lot more work to do. And I really think that a treatment system that only reaches 1/4, and that might even be a bit optimistic, of those who need help, is falling short. And great for those who are proactively seeking treatment, who are getting quality care, and that's a lot of Americans. but 75% are not. And so I think the question we should be asking is, how do we reach the rest of them, or at least another 25, 30, 40%, and get them help before they overdose and put themselves at risk?
You know, you're just talking about the Trump's administration's sort of aggressive drug policy, which seems to be twofold. One, it's on border security, and the other is on trade tariffs, right? Talk about how effective that's been. You sort of intimated that it looks like it's had some effect. The effect is really just on fentanyl, or is it across the board cocaine and other substances coming in?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, there have been these continuing dialogues with China. Some of this decline started in the Biden administration and continues in the Trump administration. And I support this very proactive effort to get China to do more to control precursor chemicals. 100%, that's worthwhile. It's important. But we really have to understand that the drug problem can't be solved or made a lot better with only demand or only supply. Supply and demand interact and influence each other. And so it's great that there was this, there's been this interruption in the quality of the fentanyl, the high potency fentanyl that's coming into the U.S. It subsided a bit. Traffickers are experimenting with different drugs to replace them. But we've also seen a huge increase in co-use of stimulants and opioids. Now about 85% of people who are found with have fentanyl in their body also have either methamphetamine or cocaine in the system. And so these polydrug patients are very complex patients. As you know, that although there are these three medications for use with opioid use disorder, there aren't FDA-approved medications for methamphetamine or cocaine.
Right.
Cocaine is coming into this country at an incredibly rapid clip, maybe 1,000 metric tons coming in each year into the U.S. Methamphetamine, we don't even have an estimate. The production, which is all happening in Mexico, it produces very potent product at very low price, also coming into the country. And so you have this evolution of the opioid epidemic into this polydrug epidemic, which is quite dangerous. And as I'm sure you all understand, is that when people are dependent on more than one substance, the treatment is significantly complicated. People need a lot. You know, they need extended treatment. They need housing. They need a way to live. They need at least a year of treatment. So you need adequate duration, high quality treatment, and then you need transition into recovery support and housing and work and life purpose, all these things that people need. It's expensive. And so we need to do more. And that's why I proposed $10 billion more spending. And, you know, I highlighted the fact that the budget is about just under $50 billion, the existing drug budget. So it's a 20% increase. And I think that, like, when I was putting together my book, of course, as an advocate in this area, I want to do a lot more, but I also want to be realistic. And also there's an absorption capacity when you expand these programs. So I believe a 20% increase combined with the couple billion dollars coming in from the litigation settlements, together that would be about a 25% increase. I think that'll make a real difference. And I proposed in my book sort of how to spend the money to be more impactful, to continue to learn from the things we're doing and evolve more rapidly as the epidemic evolves.
Well, I think we're going to sit with that for a minute. Right, I want to hear more about that. That raises so many issues from workforce to policy to all sorts of things. But for a moment, I want to go back to something I think probably everybody would agree on, that this is a terrible thing to see children in high schools and school-age children both addicted and also dying from opioid overdoses and fentanyl, maybe in particular. So I'd like to ask you to, you know, go back in a moment in time. You talked about in your book, the Obama administration and its decision with Congress to eliminate the Safe and Drug-Free Schools program. And the opioid crisis, I think, continued to expand in schools at the same time. Tell us more about this situation, your views on it, and what gave rise to that being ended? Did it not show positive results to date?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a great sort of Washington federal program issue. There were some problems with the program. This was a program that sent grants from the Department of Education to schools to help them administer drug prevention, anti-crime programs. And because there was these were grants that went into local school districts and local schools, not all the programs they implemented were evidence-based. And there were some things that folks did not well intended, but calendars distributed, and maybe they had some speakers, but not the high quality curriculum which we which experts recommend for prevention. So the program needed to be reformed, but by eliminating it, they broke this sort of funding stream that was going into schools that, as the opioid epidemic evolved, could have been adapted to these new drug threats. But now that funding stream is gone. And we've just made a decision in this country, in the federal government, that it's not important enough for every school and every class to have drug prevention education and behavioral health education and social emotional learning, all the things that are to decision making. And I mean, I understand that it is a very competitive environment, right? When you fight for your slice of your budget pie, but I would argue that in this era where there are these such easy availability of dangerous drugs and these fentanyl pills that are often sold as sedatives like Xanax, that kids can make a mistake, and well-intended people, they get something off of social media from the web. It looks like it's the real thing, and yet it contains fentanyl, and people are overdosing and dying. And to your point, you're exactly right. Overdose deaths have been going up among adolescents, but overall drug use has been kind of going down. Mm-hmm. But because the drug supply is more dangerous, the risk is greater. So I would just say, as a parent, we need to get to kids the basics. Yeah. Education about the risk, the facts, not something somebody, makes up, with AI in an hour or two. There really are approved curriculum that are tested and validated, and they can and should be available to all kids. I've also, in my book, called for an investment in earlier pre-adolescent prevention programs, recreational programs, and really making sure that even kids in impoverished communities have access to doing the things that they enjoy. And there's a lot of research based on what they refer to as the Iceland approach, where they interview kids, they survey kids, and they ask, what would you like to do? And they open up recreation centers. And if they say they want to do soccer or sports, or they want to learn a skill, or they want to learn how to do dance, whatever it is, if they're excited, getting them engaged in a positive activity really makes a difference. So I just think we're really putting the next generation at risk by not making some of these investments.
Well, speaking of strategies that might work, I'm wondering if you can tell us about the lessons you think we've learned from marijuana legalization and decriminalization, such as what has occurred in Oregon.
Yeah, really good question. And marijuana could be a whole nother podcast if you invite me back.
You might.
But so I have to say, over the years, like you mentioned, I've been involved a long time. This debate over marijuana legalization over the last 10 years has sort of taken a lot of bandwidth, right, for those of us who work in drug policy. And even though I always knew that there was risks for legalization and I never supported it, I was like, well, it's like it has 2/3 support in the country. It's really hard to fight when people want access to marijuana. Meanwhile, we've got fentanyl, heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine that everybody is against, virtually everybody is against. But I have to say, I am really disturbed at what I'm seeing in terms of the research of what people are using, the health impacts on them, the increase in psychosis, the visits to emergency room. A colleague of mine told me about the word screaming and vomiting, the combination. People are going into the ER because of their intensive high potency marijuana use, screaming and vomiting, having a psychotic episode. So I don't want to be a doom and gloomer, right? It's like there are people who use marijuana the way people might have a drink at night and don't have this effect. So
But, and I'm not calling for like drastic prison sentences, but we have to wake up to the health consequences of marijuana. You know, the our National Survey on Drug Use and Health says there are 20 million people about who have marijuana use disorder. Well, that's a lot of people. And that's 3.5 million have a severe use disorder. They're probably smoking marijuana or consuming it every day, maybe multiple times a day. And I would worry about my kid and their, you know, the development of their brain and body. So, you know, my book is focused. I have a little section on marijuana and why we need to take it more seriously. I think legalization has been oversold and not panned out as the advocates promise.
I think there's going to be a second edition of your book before too much time goes by. But one of the things that you argue for is integration of the health and the justice solutions. And you write about replacing mass incarceration with smarter, fairer approaches. I'd like to maybe have you, one, describe the approach, but two, how realistic is that concept in this current tough on crime environment we're in?
I think it's quite realistic. And all the things I talk about are already happening to some degree. And what I'm proposing is scaling them. And, you know, when you look at drug markets and look at our experience, the crack cocaine epidemic, when we had these mass arrests of dealers or user dealers, there are other ways to disrupt drug markets without arresting everybody, users, user dealers, and dealers. If police can look at a drug market and identify the leaders of the organization, the violent offenders, the instigators of problems, the key nodes, and arrest them, you know. But there are a lot of other like people more tangentially involved in the drug market. Maybe they're addicted themselves. They don't need to go into jail for 5 years. So I think that there's a way to definitely take on drug markets. I'm not saying ignore drug markets. I'm saying go ahead and take them on in a more thoughtful way and do it in a partnership with the community. So what I'm proposing, originally these ideas were by the scholar David Kennedy, who I reference, is let's find a way to take down these drug markets that builds partnership with the community, maintains support, gets rid of the worst actors, and diverts the low-level, nonviolent offenders into something else, either treatment or work or social services, or just gets them to agree to stop doing it. And, you know, I go into this more detail in the book, but I'm not suggesting, you know, someone writes a polite letter to them and to have them quit selling drugs. There's a very sort of specific protocol where the police collect evidence against everybody involved in the drug market. And they take what is a very sort of soft deterrent, like, hey, mate, maybe one day they'll get arrested, to, oh no, we already have the evidence on you. So this is your last warning. If you're caught, we see a drug dealer one more time, we have the case ready to go. So you're going to stop dealing drugs, you're going to take these other offers, or you're going to be arrested. So it's a really good program. One more thing I want to mention is people are familiar with drug treatment courts. That's sort of a typical diversion effort. And people, they occur after you're arrested. Then you see a judge, you get an opportunity to receive treatment instead of a prison sentence.
You know, Margaret, we run a large primary care system, and we take a look at untimely deaths. I think we see alcohol mm-hmm. as one of the key drivers right. to that. Talk to us a little bit about, is alcohol part of this sort of a gateway to other drugs, or what you're focusing on, how we're going to deal with the alcohol problem that we have in the country?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Alcohol addiction and alcohol-related deaths are as big a problem as the drug problem. Most of the things that I write about in my book would also benefit people that have a problem with alcohol. This type of deflection into treatment or drug courts or DWI courts. It is a very serious problem. And as we know from our conversation on marijuana, just because something's legal doesn't make it safe. It is a kind of a funny thing. You know, there isn't an equivalent of the Office of National Drug Control Policy for alcohol, right. Although there are government programs that work on alcohol. And so me and my office aren't tasked
specifically, you know, my former office left a few months ago, aren't tasked with alcohol policy. But these efforts to get treatment and housing and quality extended treatment, all that also benefit people with an alcohol problem. And a lot of people are also drinking and using drugs. And there are also many with co-occurring mental health problems. So a lot of these problems and these complex patients, you know, overlap.
Well, when you put it that way, we have to always come back to early intervention, prevention everywhere we can. And one of the going back again more to our younger people, you write about the need for intervention, early intervention, and praise recovery high schools that exist in a few places. I have to say I had not heard the phrase recovery high schools. Tell us a little bit about where they are, where they work, how are they funded, and is this a model initiative that people should be getting behind?
Well, it is. There aren't that many. I think there are only around 20-something of them. They tend to be locally funded. And, you know, There are a lot of young people who do develop a serious drug or alcohol problem, and their schooling is interrupted, right? You know, while they're in active drug use and then while they're in treatment. And then the question is, okay, how do we help get them back? And if they have successful treatment, I mean, many go back, you know, just to a regular, say, high school, but to put them in a supportive environment that is specifically set up to help strengthen their recovery has proven to be really helpful, especially those who've had a severe addiction. And as I'm sure you all understand, if somebody is 16, 17, and they've been using really these dangerous drugs, it can do a lot of damage, and it's a long journey back. So creating that supportive environment is really critical. And I believe we should have a national program supporting recovery high schools. And I also am a big believer in collegiate recovery programs. And when I was acting drug czar for a year, I visited several of them. And it's basically a place for people who either were in college or didn't get a chance to start college, who have a history of drug use and now are getting back to their education, sort of a place of their own, a support network. They're usually funded with a little bit of, as a club, with a little bit of money from schools. They're not that expensive. Maybe they have like a room and an office and some support from the school administration. But they do something even better or even more than supporting those in recovery. They sponsor sober events before football games or a movie night, and just as an alternative. You know, obviously people can do whatever they want, but it's just a reminder that people in college, you don't have to go out and get drunk every night or use drugs. There are sober opportunities. And I think modeling that, I think, reduces the peer pressure and sets a good example so that people have other options. So they're great programs. They're inexpensive. A lot of colleges all over the country already have them. They could use a bit more support as well.
Margaret, Richard mentioned Iceland. I didn't mention it. He mentioned it, so I got to go there. Favorite place to go, so I'm sure everybody's interested. I know we looked to Iceland for their saunas and their outdoor life, but talk to us a little bit about their drug prevention model and why it impresses you so much.
Yeah, I did get a chance to visit Iceland with my family, and it's a great place to visit. But it also gets pretty dark and gloomy during the winter. And the government in Iceland, this is going back 10 or 15 years or so, were worried about rising alcohol and drug use in the country, and they looked for alternatives for prevention. And they hit upon some research that had been done in the U.S. at first, and they invited the people who've done that research over to Iceland to help them start this program. And what they did is they did a very careful survey of students and parents and talked about what people want to do, what they would be interested in. And they developed a system to make it easy and cheap. They did vouchers so that every family could get a chance to have their kid or kids participate in a pro-social activity. I think those of us who worked in drug policy, you know, we weren't thinking that like starting a soccer league or a dance club or a chess tournament or something was drug prevention,
But it turns out if you give these kids an activity to choose what they want to do, you know, it's like, it's not like they need a lecture on like what drugs are and how they're risky. I mean, that's appropriate as well at a certain age in school. But if you're a 11, 12 year old kid and you're just on your phone or you're just home and it's cold and it's boring, there are distractions. And kids just really don't, they have a lot of energy and they like to be with each other and they like to follow their interests. They dropped alcohol and drug use remarkably after doing the program. And it's really something that we should look at. There have been some small models in the US, but it's worthy of a federal program. And I should say, and I write about this in the book, it used to be something back more towards the New Deal era, where we used to support recreation federally. They were building these giant swimming pools. And then as we got into the civil rights movement and integration, a lot of these places, they closed down their recreational facilities, and there was white flight out of the some of the urban areas. And, you know, it's not that much money to invest in having a recreational center.
That was a Conversations on Healthcare. Co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner visiting with former acting U.S. drug czar Richard Baum about his new book, America's Opioid Crisis, 12 Hard Lessons for Today's Drug War, and what decades of federal drug policy have taught him about addiction, treatment, and prevention. Still to come on Main Street, North Dakota's very first spelling bee. What was the winning word? That's right after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the spring of 1885, a packed Baptist church in Jamestown hosted what may be North Dakota's first recorded spelling bee, an event that was as much social spectacle as it was academic contest. Historian Dr. Tom Easern takes us back to a time when spelling wasn't just about words, but about identity, entertainment, and community on the prairie.
The spelling bee at the Baptist Church Tuesday evening was quite a lively entertainment, so says a press report from Jamestown in April 1885. Reverend S.N. Griffith acted as umpire, Professor Clemmer, conductor, and Professor Culver and C.T. Hills, captains. Between 30 and 40 participated in the exercises. Professor Culver and Miss Flagler were the last contestants for the honors, and finally the former staggered at the word millionaire, and the latter was declared the best speller. The correct spelling, in case you, like Professor Culver, are in doubt, is M-I-L-L-I-O-N-A-I-R-E, millionaire. Now, I'll parse that press report a little bit. Public school teachers often were accorded the title professor if they were male, not if they were female. Miss Flagler, the best speller in the contest, likely therefore also was a teacher. For reasons still uncertain to me, 19th century spelling bees commonly began with the choosing of sides, although the competition ended up matching individuals head-to-head. Finally, despite a history of American spelling contests going back to colonial times, this 1885 story is the first record of a spelling bee in North Dakota I have found. One chronicler has declared, "The spelling bee is a paradigmatic American institution, meaning a thing typical, maybe even defining, of the country." And fear not, I won't ask you to spell paradigmatic. Another says, "The spelling bee is a curiously American spectacle in which our competitive spirit encounters the idiosyncrasies of the English language." And no, you don't have to spell idiosyncrasies either. The spelling bee tradition indeed does stretch back to colonial times. Benjamin Franklin endorsed spelling contests in schools in 1750. Such exercises became more common in the late 1700s, after the Revolution, and particularly after, in 1783, Noah Webster published The American Spelling Book. The spelling contest was a sort of orthographic declaration of independence by which spellers propagated a peculiarly American language, eschewing old country English usage and facing forward. The American language was a tool to acculturate foreign elements and also to eradicate rustic local expression. Spellers were creators of a nation indeed. Around 1800, spelling bees came out of the schools and into public venues. The adult public embraced them as evening entertainment, even, perhaps commonly, as opportunities for flirtation and courtship. After reading many accounts of early spelling bees on the prairies, which commonly came down to a male contestant and a female squaring off as the final contenders, I have no doubt that gender and romantic considerations came into play in contest outcomes. In such manner, they reprised a trope from Edward Eggleston's 1871 novel, The Hoosier Schoolmaster, wherein romance triumphs over both social class and individual rivalry. That popular novel also seems to have inspired what cultural critics of the 1870s termed an infatuation and even an epidemic of spelling bees across the country. In the process of Western development, the trend stilled as the country settled up and settled in. But in Dakota Territory during the late 1880s, reporters commonly still spoke of the craze for spelling bees. Prairie spelling bees could be raucous, although never so much so as in Bret Harte's 1878 story, The Spelling Bee at Angels. The public was intrigued by them, as I think you will be as I spell out their history.
From colonial classrooms to frontier churches, spelling bees became more than contests. They were a uniquely American blend of education, competition, and connection, and on the Northern Plains, they offered a window into how a young society quite literally learned to spell out its future.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. There's a new exhibition up at UCross Foundation Ranch in Wyoming. It's called Resilience, and it features the work of the Foundation's most recent Native American Artist Fellows. That includes Sarah Ortegon, a visual artist, actor, and dancer, who was born in Denver and now lives on the Wind River Reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Hanna Haberman sat down with Ortegon to talk craft, creativity, and politics.
So the most recent piece that I completed is 30 inches by 30 inches. So it's a square art piece and the background is blue. And then I created buildings going up into the sky. And then on top of the buildings, I beaded a mama and a calf buffalo on one side and then a father buffalo overlooking the other buffaloes. And it's just kind of touching on how the areas in which we have cities in the Northern Plains / mountains, Denver, for example, those are literally the areas in which the buffalo used to roam. They used to caretake the area because if you do any research on buffaloes, they are amazing for the ecosystem and their history very much so is a mirror to our history as tribal people. And so it was just me bringing them back to the areas in which they originally were, kind of in a different space and time, though.
The theme of this UCross show is resilience. I'm curious, what does that mean to you, and what does that look like for you on a day-to-day basis?
Resilience is facing hardships, whatever may come, whenever they show up, and still being able to not just exist, but also to have a good impact on the things around you, the people around you, providing also life to others around you.
Looking at the lineup for this show, the exhibition features work from artists from a bunch of different tribal nations and artistic disciplines. To you, what does that say about resilience as a concept?
I think it says that resilience as a concept is open to many different disciplines, but also to us as humans. Throughout history, there have been so many issues that humans have had to overcome, and especially Indigenous peoples in the area of Wyoming. Our resilience is, it's still an everyday fight. I know that not a lot of people like to be political, but our existence in and of itself is a political existence because our treaties are tied to the federal government and our rights are also tied to our treaties.
You were born in Denver. You spent your summers on the Wind River Reservation. You live there now. How does that place influence your creativity?
Growing up in Denver, it felt way more confined. Everywhere I went, there was places that were dangerous that you shouldn't go. It just felt like I was a caged bird in Denver until I grew up, of course. And then coming out to the reservation, I was allowed to run anywhere I could. We built dirt hills, rode our bikes everywhere, swam in the river. Of course, there are always res dogs that you got to be careful of. Used to have rocks in our pockets and sticks. It was just a free existence. And it was somewhere where we could get our hands dirty. And it was somewhere that I definitely feel connected to.
What words of advice or support do you have for people who want to get more into art to express themselves? What would you say to them?
I fully support anyone who wants to also pursue their art as an art career. There are so many fellowships available. And I actually was not aware of a lot of fellowships that I am now that I'm pursuing. And it might even lead you to being a full-time artist. So there's different ways to express art and never let the square canvas limit you.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Planned Parenthood, offering health education for teens and workshops for parents on topics including health, relationships, and growing up. More at ppncs.org.
Hi, I'm Aisha Roscoe, the host of Weekend Edition Sunday. The news doesn't stop to take a break on the weekend. Around the clock, NPR reporters and their support teams are working hard to connect you to voices and stories oceans away and here in the nation. As North Dakota's home for NPR, Prairie Public relies on the generous contributions of listeners like you to help pay for the reporting you count on, even on the supposed day of rest. So whether you're in Bismarck, Minot, Fargo, Grand Forks, and everywhere in between, it's important to stay informed. Become a sustaining member right now by going to prairiepublic.org. And I hope you'll catch me Sunday mornings from 7 till 9 a.m. Central for Weekend Edition on Prairie Public.
Water as a weapon of war. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. and Israeli war against Iran is creating deep concern over drinking water supplies in the Middle East.
Major urban areas in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea rely on desalination plants that remove salt from seawater to produce fresh water, and almost all of those facilities run on energy generated from fossil fuels.
A few of these desal plants have become targets of bombs, drones, and missile strikes by the combatants. About 10 days ago, Iran accused the U.S. of damaging a desalination facility that supplies 30 villages. A spokesperson for the U.S. denied that allegation.
Then Iran allegedly damaged a desalination plant in Bahrain. Analysts worry that it's the culmination of a long-feared scenario in the Middle East in which water becomes a weapon of war.
Michael Christopher Lowe, director of Utah University's Middle East Center, wrote in The Conversation that while the Gulf's monarchies are often described as petrostates, he calls them saltwater kingdoms, superpowers in the production of fresh water from the sea.
Facilities that supply drinking water are theoretically protected under international law, but U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said that the American forces will not follow any, quote, stupid rules of engagement.
Mohammed Mahmoud of the UN told the New York Times that it's absolutely a war crime to attack infrastructure that civilians depend on by either side.
Before the war started, Iran had already been suffering from water shortages caused by drought, climate change, mismanagement of infrastructure, and overuse by agriculture.
Last year, the capital city of Tehran, with its 10 million inhabitants, had little rain and its reservoirs were stressed.
But last weekend, what has been described as black rain fell on the city. It was oil-soaked rain caused by fires producing smoke clouds following airstrikes by the U.S. and Israel on oil depots, according to CNN.
Euronews reports that the plumes of toxic contamination likely contained precursors to acid rain and carcinogenic compounds from the burning hydrocarbons. Residents were urged to stay indoors.
Long-term health risks from the smoke include neurological and heart conditions, birth complications, and cancer.
The pollutants can stay on buildings and get into waterways, affecting ecosystems for a long time.
Iran has attempted to close the Strait of Hormuz to prevent oil tankers from moving through the region, which has sent gas prices soaring. That's making people look to buy electric vehicles and install solar panels.
If demand grows, despite the Trump administration killing the rebates and incentives put in place under Biden, it will require more lithium for car batteries and energy storage.
Although EVs and renewables have lower environmental impacts, harvesting lithium, whether through open-pit mines or brine ponds, can deplete fresh water, pollute ecosystems with toxic chemicals, and release greenhouse gases.
A team of researchers at Rice University might have found a win-win solution. They are using toxic PFAS compounds, also known as forever chemicals, to extract lithium from briny water. The compounds are destroyed in the process, solving two problems at once.
PFAS substances are everywhere, in our water, in our air, and us, because they're used in so many products, from cookware to waterproof clothing and food packaging. Studies have linked them to liver damage, reproductive disorders, immune system disruption, and certain cancers.
Activated carbon is used to remove PFAS from water, but as James Tour of Rice University told H2O Radio, the carbon is often thrown in the garbage, and the PFAS ends up in the environment again.
So Tour and his team decided to turn that trash into treasure. In their study, they took PFAS-saturated carbon and mixed it with brine. They then flash-heated the mixture, which produced lithium fluoride.
Tour and his team tested their lithium fluoride in batteries, and they showed increased stability and performance.
They say their approach uses less energy and water than the two most common methods to extract lithium from brine, and they say it will likely have lower operating costs and be faster, taking only a few minutes rather than months to complete. And finally, do you know your warblers from your sparrows, finches from flycatchers? If so, your brain is likely aging well.
That's the conclusion of a new Canadian study which looked at the brains of birdwatchers and found that expert birders had more structurally compact areas related to attention and perception than the rest of us who might only recognize a duck from a seagull.
Birding requires a keen eye and strong memory, but as we age, our brain structure becomes less complex. The team says that birdwatching can build neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change, reorganize, and grow neural networks.
The study used MRIs to track how water moved through brain tissue to determine its density. Denser areas are associated with working memory, spatial awareness, and object recognition.
They found that expert birders had denser tissue compared with novices, even though they were roughly the same age.
That doesn't mean birders will avoid cognitive decline, but it might happen more slowly, giving new meaning to the word bird brain.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 17th. The Dakota Territory was created in 1861. It included what would become the states of North and South Dakota, as well as parts of what would become Wyoming and Montana. It consisted of the northernmost portion of the 1803 Louisiana Purchase. The first election of the newly formed Dakota Territory was held on September 16, 1861. 9 members were elected to the upper chamber and 13 members to the House of Representatives. The first Dakota Territorial Assembly convened on this date in 1862 in Yankton. The big prize for that first legislature was naming the permanent location of the capital. Yankton supporters backed George Pinney for Speaker of the House. They believed he would support Yankton as the capital. After his election, Pinney shocked and disappointed his supporters by backing his hometown of Bonham. That vote failed. But Pinney still refused to support Yankton and pushed for Vermilion instead. Pinney's opponents decided their best plan of action was to throw the Speaker of the House out the window. Pinney got wind of their scheme. He asked for a squad of soldiers to be stationed in the meeting room to preserve order, prevent a riot, and perhaps most importantly to him, protect the Speaker of the House. Then he resigned from the House. His resignation did not protect him from the threat. While legislators were gathered in a saloon, Pinney came flying through the window. Witnesses saw the House Sergeant-at-Arms standing in front of the broken window. The first legislature came to be known as the Pony Congress. People said that anything can happen when the legislature is in session. Pinney's flight through the saloon window wasn't the only bit of mischief during the first legislative session. During a meal at the Ash Hotel, 2 representatives got into a fight with ketchup bottles, cups, and glasses flying all across the room. Onlookers separated them as they continued to yell at each other. In spite of the foolishness, the legislature did accomplish some business during the first session. They passed 91 general laws and 25 special laws, laying the foundation for what would become North and South Dakota. In the end, the capital stayed in Yankton. The first territorial university was located in Vermilion, and stallions and swine were prohibited from running free. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me. And so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer. That kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
The immigration detention system is expanding. ICE is buying warehouses for detainees, which some residents of a Maryland community do not like.
I mean, I just think we're living in a police state and it's just getting worse. They're getting the wrong people. Just get the bad ones out, right? That's what we should be doing, but they're not.
The detention center next door, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Planned Parenthood. offering health education for teens and workshops for parents on topics including health, relationships, and growing up. More at ppncs.org.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Prairie Public's long-running television series, Prairie Musicians, returns for its 18th season this Thursday, celebrating original music from across the Upper Midwest. Prairie Public's Director of Television, Barb Gravel, will be our guest, and we look forward to also seeing you again right back here tomorrow on Main Street.